We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 8, The Puff's Perspective, part 2. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Matt Cox and Stephen Stout about the off-Broadway play, Puffs. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we're going to be talking about the off-Broadway play, Puffs, which is a kind of retelling of the entire 7-book Harry Potter series in 1 2-hour play. Very impressive. Emily, yes. You and I have talked some about our favorite fan creations, and you know that I'm particularly interested in fan maps of wizarding places. And
yes,
I'm fascinated by the way people are trying to, well, plot the unplottable, right? Put things on a map that maybe that aren't really visible. What are some of your favorite creations of the Potter fan universe?
Well, my go-to answer would be Puffs, but since we're talking about Puffs today, I'll dig a little deeper there. You know, I'm a big fan of, and this may be somewhat obscure, I don't know. I guess it's a YouTube series called Wizard People Dear Reader, and it is an individual who has created a sort of alternative narrative to be read over top. It's very literary, sort of tongue-in-cheek literary, over top of the Harry Potter movies. And he just sort of narrates himself with this sort of alternative narrative over top of these movies. And it's like at the same time absurd, but also sort of like evocatively written. And it's just like you sort of watch it and you sort of just keep gaping at it because it's really good. At the same time, it's just nuts.
I'm going to have to check that out, Emily. That's cool.
Yeah, I've never watched the entire, he apparently does at least the entire first movie. I've never watched the entire thing, but it is a goal of mine. I'm always sort of on Halloween, I'm always sort of looking for somebody to watch this with me. But I haven't got a whole lot of takers yet. So maybe it's you, Katie. Maybe you and I, this Halloween, we'll sit down.
You know, one of my favorites is one that was on BuzzFeed that was if Hermione were the central character in the Harry Potter stories. And it does reimagine the stories with Hermione as the main protagonist. And basically with the idea that she really does actually save the day every time.
Yeah.
And it's very, she's fighting the patriarchy and it is a revisioning of the series. And so I really love those. And I love Puffs so much. When Lauren Camachi told me that Puffs was on Amazon Prime, I went and I did not just rent it. I was like, I must own this, right? So that I can watch it anytime. And I have watched it like a dozen times since then. In the pandemic, it's just been so wonderful to have it. I don't know exactly why, but I'm totally with you that Puffs is just phenomenal. And so we are so delighted today to have with us two of the creative minds behind the off-Broadway play, Puffs, or 7 increasingly eventful years at a certain school of magic and magic, which is now available on Amazon Prime. First, I'm happy to introduce Matt Cox, a playwright, actor, and sound designer based in New York City. His work includes the subject of our conversation today, Puffs, and also the upcoming Kapow e Gogo Saga, the Kapowee Go-Go Holiday Specials 1 and 2, Happy Little Trees, Ababasi, and the choose-filled online adventure Guy Choiceman Decides to Save America, The Choosicle, Where You Do the Chooses. The title just cracked me up. Welcome to the show, Matt.
It's worth it just to make someone say all that out loud. happy to be here. Yay.
Wonderful. Also joining us today is Stephen Stout, an actor and producer in New York City with a Bachelor of Fine Arts from NYU. He performed in and produced Puffs. With Matt Cox, he runs online streaming events, including the branching comedy Guy Choiceman Decides to Save America, etc., the Kapowee Go-Go Saga, and various one-minute series for the app Rizzle as a series content partner. He is a member of the artistic team at the People's Improv Theater, having previously served as the artistic director. He's the co-creator of the long-running serials at the Flea Theater and ran the New York wing of the Old Vic Theater's Old Vic New Voices. He also, when he was in Puffs, played Ernie Mac and other characters, and that included a certain potions master. And so if you're thinking of who he was in the movie or in the, the filming of the play, that's who Stephen played. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So it's so great to have both of you here with us today and to know that you two are both fans of the Harry Potter series who are putting that fan perspective in action with wonderful creative work. How would you characterize yourselves as Potter fans? Matt, let's start with you.
So I really grew up with the series. Like, I was kind of that perfect age where I grew up right alongside the books. I was pretty much the same age as Harry, I believe, even. If I remember, I discovered the second book, or maybe it was the third book, at my elementary school's library, and I became hooked and read the first two or three, whatever it was. I think it was the first three. And it happened to be just before the fourth one came out as well. So I only had to wait a month or so. And I remember even magically getting the final copy the Barnes & Noble had, which was a damaged copy that they had held out for some reason. And from then on, I went to the midnight releases and everything. I was very much, during that generation of the books, a big Potterhead, and saw the movies when they came out and everything. And then, didn't think about it for a little while, in that bridge between the movies, and eventually had the idea for Puffs, and then kind of went back to the whole series and binged it all. That's my Potter experience in life.
I do think that you can read the Potter stories at different phases, and enjoy them maybe, in different ways. Stephen, what about you? How would you characterize yourself as a fan?
I'm a little bit older than the rest of, than Matt and the rest of the cast. So for me, it was a thing that towards the end of high school, it was becoming pretty big. The book series, and my high school girlfriend had read, and I had read up through, I think it was the fourth book. And then, I remember very distinctly kind of crapping out at the beginning of the fifth book with oh, we're at the Dursleys again. And then I kind of set it down until a good friend of mine in undergrad was in a wizard rock band, or I presume still is. It's just not the primary focus of her artistic oeuvre at the moment, which it was called Lillian James. And I directed a music video for them over an afternoon when they had right after the last book had come out. But then when Matt was like, hey, the next show that we're going to be doing is Puffs, I kind of became both a fandom anthropologist and tried to be more or less a historian and kind of an annoying chapter and verse for the little nooks and crannies of the weird established universe and so forth. And for me, the thing that really changed my perspective from, oh, this is just a thing that we're kind of riffing on, and other people have riffed on this before, and here we are, and so forth, was as research, I'd gone to Wizarding World, and that really locked it in for me, seeing not only is it Kong, this is concrete in Orlando that people from around the world come to and have incredibly emotional reactions to. I was like, oh, we have a responsibility towards the people who've been emotionally invested so much into this narrative to be responsible with our fooling So that's kind of where I ended up.
I think that's one of the great successes of it, is that it does, like, it takes the series kind of seriously and really does know, like, what all you said, all the nooks and crannies. I love the phrase that you use, fandom anthropologist. And secondly, I love that you went to the Wizarding World as research. That's phenomenal.
Really. Whenever I remember when you came back from that trip, Steve, and it was like, oh, yeah. It's locked in now.
No. Sincerely, my feeling of respect for the fandom was built out of a moment of evil capitalism, which is I was in Ollivander's. And it was me and Madeline Bundy, who's my partner, who played Harry and Puffs and designed the show. It was us in a room with a family with one very adorable tiny child. And the person who was selected to choose their wand out of the thing was me. And so... the moment, you know, they had, like, the wind came on when I held it in the thing, I was like, okay, I get it. I don't know. It's funny. Because, like, for me, we have a wonderful and abidingly passionate and dorky fan base. And one of the things that's always funny for me is I feel like a little bit of an imposter within it, because it's like I came to understanding what this meant to people late, if that makes any sense. So I still feel in some ways that I'm catching up. But I did try to do a little bit more of dusting off my wizard knowledge for this specific podcast.
Well, I do think that I think the Harry Potter fandom does like converts, even if they're recent. Yeah. So I think you're all right there, Stephen.
Thank you.
So Matt, tell us how the idea for Puffs came to you, and how you got the idea for the show.
Yeah. So. The sort of origin of the show, just the briefest version too. We were coming off of, myself and Steve and some of the other creatives that we work with, we were coming off a show, the Kapowie Go-Go Saga, as mentioned earlier, or the Kapowie Go-Go at the time, which was a big 3-part, like 5-hour long play that's sort of an amalgamation of all the pop culture that I really loved growing up, like Dragon Ball Z and the Final Fantasy series and Star Wars, you name it, it was probably in it. We had did the show at the People's Improv Theater for several weeks. We were doing it in pieces, and then we did like a big marathon performance, and we were kind of looking at doing that for a little while. But at that point, I was sort of starting to think of, you know, what's next, and specifically what is something that kind of still plays with this idea of like pop culture, because people were really responding to this show, and like it was sort of a play on nostalgia and how a lot of, you know, properties like to use it in a sort of evil way. I felt like we were using nostalgia to create something very new and different. And I really enjoyed that aspect of making something that does that. So I was trying to think of something else that within the pop culture frame that, you know, would be in a very attractive idea to an audience, especially because, you know, a 5-hour long show with a bunch of Dragon Ball Z's and Star Wars jokes and Final Fantasy jokes, especially in 2015, was a hard sell, believe it or not.
It's a niche audience.
It was. And it's funny too, because that show kind of came, every single one of those properties since we did that show has come back into resurgence and like blown up.
Oh yeah.
Which is very, so like the new Star Wars movies didn't exist yet. Dragon Ball Z hadn't come back. It was very funny. But so.
Look what you did.
I take full credit. So while trying to think about something, you know, that would mean something to an audience, that could probably attract an audience to come to sit in a theater and watch something for a bit, going through the things that I loved again, because that's what I tend to try to focus on in my writing. Harry Potter came up in my mind, something I hadn't, as I mentioned earlier, hadn't thought about a whole lot in recent times in 2015. And it was a very quick jump of just like the central idea was just, what would it have been like to have been, you know, another kid at this school? And then it was like, oh yeah, that would have been horrible. That would have been awful. It becomes a horror story. You're just a kid who wants a wizard education. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, oh, there's a troll. And oh no, these things are coming to kill everybody. And oh, how'd your school year end? You know, there was a giant war and all my friends died.
Oh gosh, right.
Yeah. So it's just, there's something deeply funny and deeply sad about that idea. And then it was a very quick jump of just like, oh, well, if we're focusing on the other students at the school, then it has to be about the Puffs, as we come and call them, who especially, you know, 2015 pop culture had deemed, you know, the not so cool kids of Wizard School, the, you know, the least popular ones, the one that you didn't want to be. And that was something very much that I could relate to from my life, and I think a lot more people can relate to, you know, being the not so cool kids. And then it really just kind of came together from that. And I remember as we were sitting at the bar after a Capelli Go-Go show, and Steve turned to me and just kind of went, "What's next?" And I had just had this idea, I think the week before. I was just like, "Oh, well, I had this idea about what if we focus on the Hufflepuffs and throughout the Harry Potter story." And then it was just kind of a pause, and we went, "Oh," and then we did it.
And then it happened. It emerged happened. Fully fledged, like Athena right. from the brow of Zeus.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's like the very basic origin. We scheduled a reading, like without a script existing, just to be like, let's just force an event to make it happen. And then we did a reading of like half of the show. With pretty much the cast that you see in the movies, or the film version of the show. A few weeks later, we did another full reading, and those were very different than the show ended up becoming. And then that November, we had five performances scheduled over the holiday, and the hope was really that we'd extend, you know, for maybe a month, and we'd maybe get some people who weren't our friends to come and see it, and then. Here we are now.
Yeah. And you know, Matt, I was thinking about one of the things that does come through is some of that nostalgia for the era in which Harry Potter is set, which you know, you can see it's set in the past so much more clearly the more time goes by in the 21st century. Right. And just, you know, the thing like blowing out the game cartridge, right? Yeah. And you know, the
messenger,
the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles t-shirt, and like all those kinds of things, just wonderful, and definitely put you in that moment so that it's not just something that's happening anytime, but it's happening in a specific time.
And that was trying to play on two ideas, because one, it's trying to bring the, because Puffs very much is trying to play on that idea of, you know, whenever we read a lot of us, whenever we read this series, pictured ourselves going, getting that letter and getting to go to Hogwarts. And so it was both trying to, like, if that actually happened, if we, like me very personally, because a lot of the character of Wayne Hopkins is like my own self within it. So it's like, what if awkward little 11-year-old me who loved his fantasy books and stuff got plucked in and put into this world?
Read the Silmarillion.
Exactly.
Twice.
I didn't read it twice, but I did give it a shot in middle school.
Twice.
And it didn't make a lot of sense. But it's taking from that era when we were reading these books, taking all the little pop culture things to put, you know, the audience back into that place. And also, I've always thought it's very funny that the Harry Potter series takes place in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was something that, you know, the movies didn't really touch on for a good reason, but just, you know, pop culture of the 90s is very funny to me. I don't know why. There's a lot of good opportunities for bits.
Right. Well, you said the show in its initial inception was not necessarily the show that you ended up with. Talk about the evolution of the show over time. How did it surprise you? And how did its reception surprise you? Besides the fact that, you know, it was very warmly received and it's become, you know, really a phenomenon. What about its reception, its evolution and its reception surprised you?
The hope with it was always, and Steve kind of touched on this, is that when we were building it, we really wanted to make something that like a fandom would latch on to and, you know, would transfer from being, you know, a Potter fan to maybe we could convince them to become Puffs fans. And so it was very much built with that idea, but we had no idea if that would actually, you know, work, like if people would even discover the show or if people would care enough, you know, to leave their house where there's an infinite amount of entertainment that they can take in to come to, you know, a theater space to watch something, especially when you're dealing with stuff within the pop culture realm and the fandom realms, you're competing, you know, with movies and television. So I'll never forget that very first, I think it was the first performance, Steve, remind me, that like Twitter and the internet did discover us and discover the concept.
So like when we did the readings, because we were from the beginning, obviously, we're like, we are wandering into waters that are, you know, in terms of profitable IPs for giant, you know, international conglomerates, we're like, okay, so we have to be very, you know, responsible also because, like, since this isn't made for that and it's going to be kind of adult, you know, we have to change the branding and the language and all these other things so that, like, we make this kind of alternative universe, if that makes any sense, so that we're not, so, like, basically, it's like we're not destroying your child's fandom for this other thing when we make a silly joke about, you know, like, again, AOL Instant Messenger or something. But
yeah, that was so funny.
I think it was our second reading where somebody, like, tagged us in a tweet to JKR and we hadn't done any publicity. And that was like, whoa, that's really weird. That's like, and this is not a person we know. And then after our first preview, there was like more social media pings than we would normally get for a thing that you produce for, you know, $2,500 with your friends and your own social media account that has 60 followers at this point in time, most of whom are like genetically related to people in the cast. Right. and then for the second preview, I believe it was the second preview, is when we got a Hypeable or Hypeable.com article like a couple days afterwards that was like a review of the thing, and suddenly and immediately we both like sold out all the remaining tickets to the extent that we needed to add shows immediately, not just for January that we had kind of planned, but then February and very quickly after that March, because suddenly thousands of people were that. I also distinctly remember it was the first time where I was like, also got the other side of the double-edged sword of the internet, where it was like we were being made fun of by French teenagers.
Or
a thing that me and Matt have had to do on occasion, which is like translate tweets from Portuguese to understand the Brazilian fandom's reaction to things.
Yeah, what are the Brazilians saying about the show?
And there was, I just remember distinctly, and this goes back to like, we tried really hard to be nerdy about things, was it was like, well, an American could never go to Hogwarts. And we were like, we worked it out. He's the son of American expatriates. He's a legacy. That's the reason why he's able to go into the thing. We dramaturgically solved it, goddammit. Child on the internet criticizing a thing me and my friends made. So I think that it was both the thing of like going from a position of being like, to use a kind of up our butt phrase, like creators in the geek space, to being people who's like, oh, if you're creating, you know, shows for this sort of audience, they're going to take absolutely every aspect of what you do very, very seriously, whether or not they have seen you.
And, what was so wonderful about this and glorious, though, was whenever that initial idea had happened, I was shocked that no one had really done it yet, like a full story from the Hufflepuff perspective, or the Puff perspective. And so that there was this sort of within week one of the show existing, people did catch on to that idea, was really surprising and wonderful. And then to further that end, that like how it evolved beyond that, I was luckily because, you know, the way sometimes theater works, we teched the show basically up until the minute we had to open the doors for the first audience. We never actually got to the point where I could pass the sound design, because I did the sound design as well, off to the board up. And so I ended up running the sound for a few months of the show. And so I sat on a little perch and got to watch every performance, and got to see the way that the audience reacted. And as the audience grew and became more Potter fans, I was able to kind of tweak to exactly the specifics and any ideas that came up with how that audience was reacting and engaging to like the specific jokes to the text or the movies. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of, you know, the months that the show existed, I kind of kept tweaking and changing and changing and changing. And then since we were at this improv theater, the show was very much focused on being a comedy when it first started. It still had, you know, the more tragic ending of it, but the jokes and the bits were kind of the focus. And then we eventually, when we found out that the off-Broadway move was going to happen, a lot of these tweaks that I was making as the show was happening were then evolving into becoming more of a focused story and becoming more about how to tell this tale as a whole, while there's still plenty of bits, but how do we really play into the emotional heart of the show as well? And then that's really what evolved beyond that. And that became the focus then.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that was also really cool was, it was like, so the thing that we kind of like say that we do, it's like these geek stories that are filled with jokes, but then also like surprising turns into like heartfelt situations and things. And the fact that, and that was like the thing that we had like Trojaned horsed over from Kapowie. And that people were picking up on that was really cool. So one of the things that, you know, Matt, as he was revising and so forth, we were able to kind of have the strength to kind of go with some of the harder choices that we were facing. Like the original ending, like in the White Room, there was a bit when Cedric appeared and there was a bit when Helga appeared. And then like at the train station in the end, we had a thing that we later used in one of the Puff sequel plays, where Oliver had been wandering in the woods and found the Resurrection Stone and they had Wayne's ghost in it. And then like these were things that we were slowly able to like revise out and let things kind of be broken and jagged at the end, because like the thing that we realized was the jokes were all well and good, but people were also going along with the story, which wasn't a thing that we had necessarily known was going to be the thing when somebody comes in thinking they've spent their, like, I forget, our initial ticket price was like $5 or $10. Like, their $10, like, they got their fill of the jokes they came for, and then they kind of stayed for the story.
Yeah, you know, yeah, we've done some episodes about humor. One of our regular guests is a psychologist, Louise Freeman, and she's talked about this some too, the idea that the humor actually in the Harry Potter stories are very funny too. I mean, so that it fits in with the genre. You're not going counter to it, but that the humor actually opens you up to some of the emotional resonances in a way that's unique. And so I absolutely think that you all hit the right button on that. And there is a little tone shift at the end, but it's not a different play at the end than what you started with. So I, you know, kudos to you all for all of that. You know, you're sculpting it as you go along. And I think that really shows us something about the, you know, the ability of theater as a medium to be adaptive and to sort of, you know, be able to read the audience. I'm fascinated by the way you were able to do that. What do you think about, you know, Harry Potter or Puffs especially lends itself well to theater as opposed to some other genre of, you know, the fandom?
So the thing that we knew when we started was, like, the other guys have all the money. Like, they have concrete and four, you know, three zip codes around the world to the tune of millions of dollars. These movies have, like, enormous CG budgets and so forth. But the thing within theater is literally rough magic. You can, to be pretentious, it's this Shakespeare thing, when we speak of horses that you see them. You know what I mean? Part of the reason why I think the show lends itself or takes advantage of the theater thing, and especially when it's played in, like, one unbroken two-hour chunk, is you do go on a full journey with the people from from ignorance to knowledge, childhood to a form of adulthood. It's also the fun of, you get the joy of seeing actors play 12 different parts in the things and fill out this thing, and that becomes its own source of energy and joy and what's new, what's new, what's new. The funny thing that also happened is that there was a bunch of choices that we had made, at least initially, about, like, oh, well, we'll try and do some kids' party magic, or, like, some of these things that take advantage of old sort of Victorian era stage magic things. And at the time that we had started, there wasn't five movies coming out. There wasn't a two-part international play that was happening. But the thing that ended up being funny when we went and saw Cursed Child, and I had a friend who was assistant director on Cursed Child, who had came and seen Puffs after we'd been running off Broadway for a sec. And it was like, parallel thinking. Like, you just had a lot more money to solve those problems. But it was the same thing of, like, oh, when we're doing, like, it's our second task looks the same. And we both came up with the same idea. Which is that, like, there's going to be people holding this bar, and that's going to be the thing for the stadium, and your brain will fill in that it's the stadium on the lake. And so, like, the thing for us that was really important is how much, given that the other thing exists to the tune of millions and millions of dollars or billions or whatever, it's already visually exists in your brain, so we don't have to, like, paint those walls that are already painted. We get to, like, try out something new. So, like, that's the reason why, like, the costumes are the way they are, because we were like, oh, there's this thing that happens with wizard families where each wizard family seems to decide what era they dress in, if that makes any sense. Some that are like, we're medieval, we dress medieval,
right?
And then you have others that are like, no, we are solidly Doctor Who from the late 60s. So, like, we had when Maddie was costuming the show, that was, like, the thing that drove us was, like, oh, we get to play in that sandbox with what this stuff is. Also, so that you can differentiate those 11 actors from each other by virtue of not having them all in the same uniform and so forth. So it's also a way that we could have, you know, actors in their mid-20s to early 30s play teenagers.
The stage is really one of the only places you can do that without it becoming, like, an extra level of weird or funny, whatever way you want to go. To add to that too, one of the reasons I think it works so well is, you know, the show, to also put this sentence out there, the show is a parody. It is, you know, an unofficial part of this world. And I think parodies work very differently on a stage than they do in film or in books, especially if there was a parody novel of this, it would be very different, because you would be almost directly parodying, you know, the style and the format, while a stage adaptation kind of allows you to do that while also transitioning it to something new and different, which is one of the reasons I guess a stage play made sense to me. It's also, you know, it was the tools that we had. We knew actors and we had a stage. So I guess that's what we were going to do to tell the story. There's also just something really remarkably fun. And what you would also get this, you know, in a film, but that the actors are there in the room with the audience and everyone mm-hmm. gets to kind of share this experience together, especially when you're engaging with something that everyone already has a different experience with. That kind of creates its own magic, dare I say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you can tell that even from the film version, you can feel the energy of the audience at mm-hmm. like you're there, right? You're at the certain school of, you know, magic and magic. You know, you feel like you're a part of the whole thing, and there's a collective group energy that's able to work on that. And I love the phrase, Stephen, that you used, rough magic, as well, and the way that, you know, that with theater you can just sort of sketch something out. And then the layering of, you know, when you have the same actor playing multiple characters, the layering that you can do in terms of suggesting something about those relationships, I think is really fun too.
It's why we, the easiest, when we were figuring out like on a coffee napkin what the double casting would be, the Cedric Voldy thing made the most sense for us, because it was both that like, we have this actor that you're going to fall in love with from all of it, because it's like doing a narrative about the Titanic, right? You know the Titanic's going to sink. You know this guy's going to be ripped from you. But hopefully over the course of like 45-ish minutes, we really get you to take your eye off the ball. And then, you know, you lose him. And then he's gone for 10 minutes. And then when he comes back and they're in a robe with a piece of masking tape over their nose and you put two and two together, it's like, it's basically, it's like every time we kind of like... Every time we emotionally wound you as an audience, we're going to give you an ice cream cone in a little bit. You know what I mean? It's what you're saying. Like, that's the joy of what the double casting is and so forth. So we're happy that that shines through.
And another thing that reminds me of, I mean, I think you can't help but think about the parallels with The Cursed Child and the centrality of Cedric in both mm-hmm. of those. And even what you're suggesting, like Cedric goes to the dark side in the Cursed Child, and having that double casting, it's so interesting to just see those see those, both of them re-envisioning, or they're revisiting the Hogwarts years and doing it in such an interesting way that yet is quite different.
It's so funny though, because it is that fourth book, it's the same thing, because like, you know, in canon with Wizarding World in the parks and so forth, like that takes place during the Triwizard. So like there's something about this being like the apotheosis of what the franchise is to a certain extent. It's both the last gasp of fun and games, and like, you know, it's the childish like Nancy Drew mystery stuff slowly being morphed into the harder fantasy requirements of the, you know, like the Campbellian ethos of what the character uh-huh. has to do. And for whatever reason, it's like subconsciously it's funny. Cause again, like when we started, there wasn't a Cursed Child thing. When me and Matt were up one night after one of our closing performances at the pit, translating Brazilian Twitter. Cause that was where all the spoilers were.
And they were the first to not keep the secret.
But when we were like, oh, weird. It's the same thing. This insistence on this, you know, because I think it is the moment when, like, when you're absorbed. Because I know, like, for me, and even as a casual fan, it was the, like, oh, shit moment when, you know, you're in the graveyard and suddenly the boy's dead. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, like, it's so foundational to a lot of people's relationship to the evolution of how the series goes. Mm-hmm. So that might be why, like, there's this subconscious insistence on it as, like, the source text everything has to go back and keep poking at. But it wasn't intentional on our end necessarily. It's just funny.
Yeah,
you know, we've talked on this show about how the fourth book is such a linchpin of the series, and it makes sense that Cedric is, you know, a linchpin character of the series as well, and that's just kind of naturally coming through.
Yeah, and you all have also adapted the show for an Australian audience. How was that?
Oh boy, it was a good time. what a surprise. This company over there just sort of came to our producers and said that they wanted to do the show. And then I kind of didn't believe it for a while. And then I was on a plane And we got to go out there, myself and Chris McCarthy Parker, the director, and we went, spent the month there during the rehearsal process, and it was very surreal. It was also just really wonderful, though, to see just how an audience across the world still engages with the show in similar and some different ways. But particularly what was really fun about Australia, though, is that they have a sort of a cultural appreciation of the underdog, much more so than we do. Like, their biggest hero stories tend to be underdogs. And there's a phrase there. I'm trying to remember what it is. It's like you cut off the poppies or something like that. That's not what it is. before they get too tall. It's something like that. The idea, though, is, you know, if a person, especially in their pop culture, if someone's like very proud of who they are and they really want to be famous, you will get cut down and people won't like you for it. You have to be very humble. And that's like what they respond to as a society. So what Puffs really gets to play with that idea. And they really responded to that. And then we really just leaned on the cast to give us a lot of Australianisms and different ways of phrasing things to put into the show so that, you know, it feels, because the show as it is right now is very much an American perspective of the series. And so we really leaned on them to help us make it so that it was also an Australian experience. So taking that same idea of like, what is it like if I got plucked and put into Hogwarts? What's it like for, you know, Ryan Hawk, Australian man who played Wayne, to get plucked and put into Hogwarts? And yeah, it was really fun. It was a really fun time.
It was also a thing that we would joke about in like a couple, like when the show started taking off kind of, I don't think it was even before we like were optioned for Off-Broadway. It was a thing we were joking where it's like, oh, any of the local references, like the New Mexico stuff, you know, like in the high school production of it, they should just change that to whatever their like local thing would be. So we had went and we did a workshop of the show when the text was changing. We went down to Gainesville, Florida, to at the University of Florida to do like a workshop of the new text. And like that was the first time we changed any of the jokes. And it was the first, you know, to be like, you know, like Oliver's from New Jersey in New York, which gets a laugh. But in Florida, it was Tallahassee, which got a big laugh that none of us on the creative team understood.
Yeah.
But we like recognized that we were like, OK, this bit that we had that we would adapt this to where whatever the local audience was, that's a good thing to do. Because it's also it's the reason why also our trio doesn't speak with British accents, if that makes any sense. We want it to be as close to the experience of whoever was the person picking up the franchise when they were a kid or at whatever point in their life and relating to like themselves being in it. So, you know, like there's a high school doing it in China over the next couple of weeks. And I imagine like it'll be funny to know what their local references for various bits of it are, for what those things are and how those are different. Yeah. But
I'm trying to remember what Australia, Wayne was from a made up place called Sheepsheared Flats, Queensland. Oliver was from a neighboring like suburb of Melbourne called Craigieburn, which I think I kind of pushed for just because I thought the name was funny. It made me laugh, which sometimes that's what you got to do. And you got to hope that someone shares your sense of humor. Instead of field trips, they all kind of looked at me. They didn't really know what that, I think they knew what it was, but it's like they don't use that words. But it was so, whenever in our version, everyone yells field trip, they yelled excursion. Which is really delightful. They also have a word called dag there, where you like lovingly call someone a dag. And that's kind of sums up like a lot of someone who's very uncool, but they're cool because they're uncool.
I like that there's a word for that.
Yeah, yeah. That's which awesome. Was really great. And that was the thing we even kept saying. We had a something of Australian celebrity in the show there as well. His name's Rob Mills, who was on Australian Idol. And that was what they kept telling us. It's like, oh, he's such a dag. He'll be perfect for it. We like, great. I don't know what that means.
I'm going to trust you on this one.
I can't tell if that's a bad thing or a good thing. Then eventually I understood it.
The last translation that we haven't done for incredibly convoluted legal reasons is because the show hasn't been done in the UK yet. So, like, we haven't had to figure out how to translate Puffs back into the original English, if that makes any sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's the one bridge that we like creatively haven't had to figure out yet.
But I love how playful it is. Like the show is a kind of, it's elastic, and that makes it, I think, you know, more widely appealing potentially too. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, we want it to feel handmade. Like that's the point is it's like, even so, like there have been high school productions of Puffs at this point in time that have larger budgets than probably we had off Broadway. wow. And we've been sent we've been sent you know, bootleg footage that shouldn't exist of, you know, like kids on brooms flying on actual flying.
Yeah. Wow.
And it comes into the, like, the thing that I always refer to as, like, the Evan Almighty effect. No offense to anybody who worked on the movie Evan Almighty. It's just the example I use for this, which is, like, comedy doesn't get funnier the more money you throw at it. So we want the walls to shake, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
Well, Puss is just such a witty, funny, smart show. It feels right at home here on our academic Harry Potter podcast. Tell us about both of your own academic interests and which of those sort of interests maybe you brought to Puffs.
I have a drama degree, but my self-taught adult education, as I continue on in this, you know, world of ours, falls into like more of history, cinema and media studies and literature. And a lot of the things I had done when I first graduated from college was I spent a lot of time working on Shakespeare plays and things like that. And what you do when you're doing modern Shakespeare is you have to pick up these texts that have been picked over endlessly by people who are much smarter and more talented than you are. And you have to kind of like look at it sideways and try and find, if not a new angle on how to interpret a line or a scene or something, at least something that feels like there's an energy or a juice to it. So when we were doing Pops, that sort of brain that I have did get applied to like even my own performance with that. Like, for example, in, you know, year four, Dumbledore's notoriously in the movies asks Harry with an amount of passion that people have found suspect if he had placed his name in a fiery cup. But for me, and Matt had written it like that, and we did readings of it, and I was like, this is very funny. But I was like, I just want to try it once where I do it the way it's quote unquote supposed to be. And the fans said, like, we tried to not do things that were super fan servicey, because it's kind of the easiest and cheapest like energy that you can get is like, because basically you're sitting in a room and you're going like, we all agree about this moment.
Yeah.
isn't it great that we all agree? Now we've gone through 30 seconds of agreeing. Now let's move on. But like for that, like trying to do it as like he asks politely and so forth with what the thing is. And then that getting like a big reaction, it was like, OK, so that was really, you know, like, oh, again, Shakespeare thing. It's like this line that's normally loud, I'm going to do it soft. but it was also a thing that part of the reason why we were so specific about trying to make sure that our little like parallel universe could actually, in theory, fit into extant canon. And this is slightly at a time when HP canon was a little bit more agreed upon, to put it politely. So it was important so that you didn't have a moment in the back of like the most sticklery rude fans enjoyment of the show. There wasn't a thing that would take them out, if that makes any sense. Right. So there's only like a couple moments where we like chose to do the thing that, you know, like if you're doing a story based on real events, you're like, I had to conflate these two people to make it, you know, make sense in terms of the story or the narrative of it. But like for us, it was like Zach Smith coming back to school to fight in the battle is, I think, our only real thing where we're different from what canon is. But technically, that's not the Zach Smith, you know, it might be time traveler Zach Smith. Am I wrong with that?
No, yeah, that could be. There's a whole long thing there. You can look at our YouTube channel if you really want to go down that route.
Oh, neat.
Oh, yeah.
The readings. We did some charity readings of the sequel and prequel plays. And
so within my own
time travel Zach Smith. Yeah. We could talk about that later.
Yeah. No. But going into my own media studies sort of like interest. So we basically like we made a franchise as a bit. Like we were closing, like again, when we started doing the play, there wasn't five movies about beasts coming out. And, you know, Eddie Redmayne, I guess, stopping nuclear war or starting nuclear war, depending on how you interpret that moment when you smoke from the skull bong. So like that didn't exist in this play, didn't exist. But when they started cropping up, it was like, again, we were closing at the Pit. The script for Chris Child was coming out like 2 days before our last performance. And me and Matt kind of looked at each other late one night. We're just like, oh, it'd be really funny to do the world's first parody of this other property right like 2 days after it came out.
I think it was like 3 days after the script came out. Yeah. It says, yeah, 19, now it's called 19-ish years later, or There and Back Again, A Puff's Tale.
Oh, I love that.
And three.
Oh,
yeah.
I've got to check this
but
out.
But also the thing, because we're nerds and fans of, you know, both handmade personal art and literature, but also like giant transmedia storytelling, that sort of became an ongoing bit. So when the movies started coming out again, it was like, oh, well, we'll do one of these as a silly reading. And then like when people started leaving the show, Matt was like, I'm gonna write a goodbye play for everybody that's basically like Endgame hadn't come out, but is basically like Puff's Endgame. It's like tying together all the things that are, and the thing that's funniest with that play, which is called Puff's Three Eventfulness Maximus, is that's like almost an entirely original joke narrative within our own pocket of our own created universe, if that makes any sense. So
this well goes deep is what we're saying.
Yeah.
But like that's the thing, is it's just, I don't know, it's a simple creative note that like when I teach workshops or things, I say to people, it's like, make something you would like to consume. And so for us, that included this ongoing joke that we were making a 12-hour long franchise.
Yeah, and that kind of does fall into, it's like, I don't have as fancy of like an academic interest, not really, because I have a theater degree, and that was mostly what I did, other than like writing, but I was mostly focused on that. But for many years, whenever I moved to New York, I worked at Midtown Comics in Times Square, a comic book store. And so I very much have been a person who has consumed a lot of various forms of pop culture and media and things like that. And comic books particularly, you know, have what if stories and stories that take place of like, oh, well, these people were up here doing something. You didn't know about these other people who were also here doing something else. And so a lot of those lessons were taken and put into Puffs. And also a lot of the lessons of like how to engage with a fandom came from that as well, of like giving people something to be excited about as like a means of, you know, extending their interest in your work, but also as a thank you. And a lot of these extra plays that we ended up writing were very much something, because we kept noticing, we were lucky enough to have people who kept coming back and back and back to see the show. And so within the play, there's moments that there's like improvised moments or moments that had like five or six alternative lines of dialogue that the actors could say.
Right. There's the whole thing when they're doing sports, which I just love as a nerd who, like, they're all the same to me. I just love that it was called sports. And then I guess, you know, there's a kind of section of that that can be improvised. And at the end of the, you know, the film version of it, you do get to see some alternative things that he says is that the sports tryouts.
Yes. And so that kind of came about. I was in the middle of writing the show still, because this kind of goes off actually what Steve was even saying. Basically, the original ending of the show very much dealt with, you didn't know, this is talking about like engaging with like the actual story and the fandom and not changing things too much. The original version of the play actually had the Puffs like secretly in the background solve this mystery that actually caused everything to change, and they really saved the day in the background. And that was in the initial draft of the show. It was this thing called Helga's Magic Box of Magic, and it did not really work. I remember we looked at each other after like the first week of rehearsals, and it was like, ah, something's not right here. And so I kind of went back and rewrote the entire show over the course of a week. And that's where the sort of more underdoggy, it was just the Puffs were also their story sort of came from. But I was sort of catching up to the cast as they were rehearsing year six. And there had been a funny bit with the Zach Smith character in year five, where he was Wayne's like new best friend, who was just this rude guy. I ended up cutting that little bit. Then we got to this moment though, where I wanted to keep this like sports tryout just to sort of play on the Ron storyline in the sixth book. And it was just like, oh, let's just bring the Zach Smith character back. I don't have anything written yet. So Nick Rio's a wonderful improviser. It's like, what? Just say something. And it started as a single sentence of like an improvised line that became two sentences. And it eventually became, you know, the final performance off Broadway was about 20 minutes long. partially on my own fault. I guess we just added a lot of stuff to it, but it just became this giant, massive thing. But to the point I was making earlier, that was very much something I encouraged because it rewarded people who kept coming back to the show because they got to see something different. There's a few other moments within the script even that can be different, like the Leanne's line to the potions teacher of whatever the potion is. There's options in the script of that.
Yeah, and I like how they're giving opportunities for other kind of media references, like you were saying. Yes. That it's all very intertextual in a very contemporary way. That because you've got all these overlapping fandoms, and mm-hmm. so you're really making use of that with these moments.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The one other one that's not actually it's not in the film because this came about after the film. Choose your own line, I guess, is the Mr. Valdi, as he's called in the script. Whenever he comes and does the speech at the end inside everyone's head, there was a third bit, like after he leaves, where he thinks that the megaphone is still on. That just became, again, it just became like a longer and longer monologue. These ones are all written and they're in the script. But there's like 15 different options there. One where he's gotten into Pilates. and the best one that eventually came, this even just came about, so it had originally been a line that kind of spoiled Chris Child, where it was like, oh, is anyone a spoiler for Chris Child, if you're, you know, don't want that still in your life. like, is
spoiler
anyone,
for an yeah. internationally best-selling book,
they've had their chance.
But it had that been like, right. it had been just a short line of like, oh, does anyone want to see a picture of my newborn daughter? I was like, oh, and then what do you mean the megaphone's still on? But that it was requested that we change that, which we happily did. Mm. And so then it was just like, oh, well, I guess I'll just write five different monologues for James Foey to learn. Then eventually, and then he was like, oh, cool. And then I think it was like he had like 2 or 3 weeks left in the show. He kind of looked at me, he was like, if you wanted to write more, that'd be fine. And so I did, and the best, and that's when they really started to get weirder. And the best one came from that, which is just he goes, "I'm going to ask like an awkward question right now, and I need everyone to be honest. Where are my shoes? Like I've been back for 3 years, and no one's offered me a single pair of shoes or slippers. We're outside. We're in the woods. I've stepped on several rocks." Where are my shoes? And it's very funny. I think Steve kind of gave the idea for that one as well.
There was, yeah, no, it's like, it was, it's, sorry to use adult world. It was like, I had a very tiny shit post list, if that makes any sense, for things that were like, okay, if we want to be very nice and respectful of this property and this fandom, da, da, da. But here are the, like, and again, as the slight outsider, here's the five rocks I can throw that I think will really hit. but the thing that's fun about that, though, again, because you have a group of people who really care about this thing, is when you hit upon something that none of them had put into words, but mm-hmm. they all have agreed on without knowing. And that was the thing that was really funny with the shoes bit, was the sound wasn't even just, it's like a laugh plus recognition. You know, like you're seeing everybody do the math in their head and they're laughing right. about it, which is this whole other subcategory of like audible audience reaction that is just like, if you could bottle it and sell it, would be just delightful.
Yeah, Stephen, did you do that with some of the, I was thinking about one of the best parts for me was when you have those little scenes where Snape is, or I should say a certain potions teacher is, teaching the kids sex ed, which, I mean, also, like, when are they going to... Of course, they have to teach the teenagers that sometime. And the idea that you would have the potions teacher teaching that. Was that something that you were improvising? Because there were, like, several different iterations.
It was a couple different things. That was the birth... That was in, the first reading we did. And I couldn't get through it because, again, it was a thing like... The minute the visual, even in everybody's heads, when the stage direction was read at our first reading, made everybody in the room laugh.
Right.
And then, because again, you have to, when initially this was made, we knew we were making it for people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, kind of, who would go to a comedy club in Midtown Manhattan, you know, at 9:30 on a Tuesday night, because that was like the slot we could get at that theater. So that's a different audience that when... Even as we were running at the pit and suddenly we had, you know, like tiny humans arriving in costume and we're like, oh, families are starting to come to this and things. It became a thing where I think me and Matt, we discussed this. It was like, we don't want to be the people who literally teach them this. So suddenly it was like I was allowed to have a bit of freedom in terms of like, oh, we Matt wrote in like a donut appears out of nowhere, and we went like up three flights of stairs near Herald Square to this magic shop, and we were like going down a list of things. We're like, do you have any like foam donuts that just appear?
Do you have
and
magic just, donuts?
Yes. Yes. Yes, we do. We're like, oh, okay. That was like, you know, I'm glad our like magic ad libs worked out. So like there was that with the donut and the wand, which especially during like you do these rehearsals when you're running a show to put in understudies called put-ins. And like when it's all adults in the room who've been doing the show 900 times, you get very ridiculously silly with playing with those props. But also it's the Matt just let me run with being able to play around with those sorts of things. Also from this man who I took very seriously, who is world beloved worldwide, like how would he actually try and navigate this situation?
Yeah, you feel some sympathy.
No, exactly. Right. That's so much funnier than just like, what if Snape said dirty words?
Yeah, agreed. A lot of these stories are sort of bonded by this idea as well. I don't know if you're picking up on this. Like a lot of the bits and a lot of what some of the most memorable moments of the show kind of just came about in the room as a thing that we were like, oh, that is really funny. And then I kind of took whatever the actor was, whatever they particularly found fun and funny about it, and then ran with that in one direction. And then when an audience was gotten put in front of an audience and they were responding to a certain segment of it, we're like, oh, they really love that. Like, what's the way to double down on that or back up in a different direction afterwards? And so it was just like a kind of constant play on each other where nothing was precious or sacred. It was really just like, how do we make the most fun thing to make people fall in love with?
Now, so Stephen, you've called Puffs a comedic love letter, a send-up, a critique of Harry Potter. How does the show do like all of those things at the same time? And like, how do you feel about, we haven't really talked about so much the critical aspects. How do you feel about critiquing, you know, a work that you actually quite like?
So to begin with, the sort of love letter aspect is, for me, the parodies that are most near and dear to my heart are the things that are, they basically do whatever the chosen genre is. Monty Python, the Holy Grail, uh-huh, to an extent until it gets stopped, is, you know, attempting to do, you know, the Arthurian legend. Life of Brian, same thing. The Cornetto trilogy with Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright. A lot of, like, Hot Fuzz was in my head as, like, oh, we're doing Wizard Hot Fuzz. So the thing the Hot Fuzz does is it's about trying to, you know, and again, this is more complicated and nuanced discussion than we should be having at the moment, but, you know, like what it's trying to do is do for like routine police work what like action movies about rogue police do, if that makes any sense, but while still shooting it as if it's a Michael Bay movie. So for us the thing was the equivalent of, we know we're gonna look, if you go to like, again, like the normal like hero's journey thing, we have a protagonist who's obsessed with the hero's journey. We end with a giant power battle, an earnest power battle where adults are running around. At one point, they were the ends of paintbrushes going pew, pew, pew. But like, that's the earnest part of it. That's the love letter. The fact that there's a, you know, a mystery with Megan's mom that has a reversal that happens about 2/3 of the way through the story, similar to like most of the ways the books are structured in their sort of like repetitive thing. One of the shit posty things was like, the school would be a lot safer if they just shut down from like March through June. Like if they just shut down for those three
that's the dangerous months.
Go online.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing as like when I remember watching the show 24, I was like, if you just like, you just have to wait for the last 30 minutes of every hour, and that's when all the bad stuff's gonna happen. But getting to kind of like earnestly do those things, because that also takes something that's kind of like a souffle, this very fun and light, jokey experience you're having, and it makes it somewhat feel like you're having a full meal. You're having a full experience for whatever amount of money you have so generously given us. The satire of it is the things where it's like, yes, we switch the headmasters when the actors would have switched out. We do the things like the, oh, when Dumbles would shout at this point, he talks like this. We have a house elf at one point that we just shove into the narrative to get some fake holy unearned pathos that hopefully right. throws you off the rhythm so that when we actually kill a child right after it, you're like, what the hell? But there's the, and you know, those things that are the things that are more the like the fandom jokes that for somebody who's that basically are like the satire is there to reward the people that that was the thing they wanted to come and see.
Yeah.
Everything else for us that might be the reason that like we're passionate about playing around with geek narratives and things like that. That's the thing that we have to earn by virtue of doing these jokes and these other things. Mm-hmm. In terms of the more critical stuff, and we tried to be, we're very nice and limit our kind of most, you know, and again, 5 years ago was a very different time in terms of looking at what this franchise was, both from an authorial standpoint and from, you know, a canonical standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it wasn't about, like YouTube thing bad, like videos about like such and such is the worst, that's why this thing sucks, is very limiting in terms of comedy because it's like you're not actually being, there's no energy to it. There's no narrative juice to it. There's nothing like that. So the things that we are, you know, sort of critical about and try to reflect in the show, a lot of the ones that honestly come to mind for me are more in reaction to how the franchise kept growing once we were running. So like, for example, it was the thing when we were again... I didn't think I would bring up Brazilian Twitter three times. When we realized,
you're welcome for the shout outs, Brazilian Twitter.
Yeah, thank you. You did the Lord's work in helping two nerds in Astoria, Queens figure out a narrative. When it was clear that Cursed Child was at least playing on a certain sort of trope of platonic male friendship with, you know, Albus and Scorpius, which is the thing that, like, when you watch the thing is this charming, energetic heart of the show, but you're also having a fandom that's hungry for more intersectional representation, and you have this opportunity to do something, and you don't, while ostensibly claiming to be a, you know, inclusive franchise, blah, 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 you have this pent-up amount of disappointment in your fandom. It's a very, you know, like fandom at the moment is very complicated in terms of how these things navigate both, you know, fulfillment, but also not catering towards the worst impulses of your meanest and most terrible fans. Mostly that's a Star Wars fandom issue at the moment. But
yeah.
So we have this moment where me and Nick Carrillo hold hands in this thing where it's like, oh, they're little, like, they're little buddies. But then we earnestly were like, well, no, let's, for this tiny moment that's, again, pretty much unearned, but let's for 1 second just say, yeah, they're these two little queer boys and they're going to hold hands and they're going to run off stage. And we knew that that was like, that's not enough. That doesn't like absolve us for like whatever representational things that we have in terms of our narrative. But the thing that was both like simultaneously very heartwarming and very sad was like immediately we had queer fans respond to that thing. Hmm. And then so in the subsequent media that like the subsequent Puffs tetralogy that Matt's like fleshed out, that sort of thing was just taken at face value. Okay, these two characters are queer and they were these buddies who were, you know, something else bloomed and then one of them died. And then that's where the one of them now like works as the train conductor. And that's earnestly what that story is of this person. And that, you know, for a bunch of people, it's a very resonant thing. And it comes out of just responding to, okay, this giant media franchise can't have the courage of its convictions mm-hmm. for reasons that are very, you know, earned to criticize, but we, us on our smaller thing in our, you know, parody thing, well, let's just do one thing with that.
This is actually so much, I think, a part of what you see in a lot of fan works and fan fiction is that they are able to take, you know, some of those things farther than the big franchise, and they're able to rewrite things as they wish that the major series had, and that's one of the things I think that drives so much of the, you know, the attention to fan fiction and why people like to take it in. And I think your play definitely is, your plays are doing that, and I think that's mm-hmm. part of their popularity for sure.
Yeah, it's people trying to find a space within the work for themselves, and if it's not there, they're right. going to make it. So it was very interesting to be to be dipping into like Potter fandom at the moment when like it was having its Phantom Menace moment, when it was having the things that like kind of came out and were like, wait, we're now not all in agreement on stuff. So that was like when we, so like the dude, Where's My Fantastic Friends? And a bunch of the subtitles.
That's the prequel play, yeah.
That's the 1920s play.
Oh my God.
There's a bit, the meanest bit of writing that is in any of our stuff is this sequence where it's a class trip to the, you know, MACUSA, basically, where the kids are just asking basic questions about American history that aren't being taken into account with the now established new canon. Because it's like, that's the thing. It's like, I remember we were reading that stuff on Pottermore when it was posted. It was like, did they just dash this off over the weekend without like consulting anyone from the various subcultures represented here? Because right. you're going from a homogenous mythology, the homogenous mythologies of England, Wales, Scotland, not saying that they're all the same, but like you're pulling on this sort of more like Tolkien-esque, C.S. Lewis-esque established world of what, you know, mythical beings and creatures are. But now you're wandering into things that are actually more complicated and are foundational to people's religions. There's one tiny bit that talks about like that, like one of the most known magic, I think, wand stores in the U.S. is located in New Orleans. And it's like, okay, it's really great that you guys didn't foreground that and go into like co-opting, you know, like Santeria or voodoo into this other thing. Do you know what I mean? Like there's these things that increasingly, as you have an author who's not letting go and letting, you know, like experts do your research for you to a certain extent while you play in these sandboxes that aren't yours to play in.
Yeah. And she doesn't know much about American history. She's super, you know, well-educated in those traditions you were talking about and in European literature. And she didn't know much about America. And that just really shows all my, you're speaking well, my boy, language boy, now, Stephen.
Boy, did she take some swings at it, though.
Well, oh, my gosh,
okay,
I know.
So, like, to get into the critiques of that stuff, it's like, okay, so the Magical Congress of the United States of America is founded 70 years before the United States of America exists.
Right. Yeah.
So where does the name come from?
Where does the name come from?
Yeah, I got a whole.
Well, and our answer is that there's a ghost of an early wizard settler named Martsy Partsy who appeared as a ghost and told them to call it America. No questions, no necessary. And then he died of scurvy.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He also comes up with the American wizard torture methods. He also decides the no toilets thing at Hogwarts and all kinds of those things.
Yeah. And I mean, like, again, this just comes from a place of, you know, we're nerds trying to make, you know, better nerd content than previously has been made in as much as our to the best current level of our understanding and trying to see where our blind spots are and grow out those areas or to know, you know, into which spaces it is not ours to tread. And I just feel like if we're able to do that when we're making, you know, some money off of it, it's like if somebody is making their entire living off of these things, like you should be able to do more than a weekend's worth of research into stuff. So,
Yeah, I have a whole article about this, actually. You know, so like yeah, you are definitely talking the, you know, my language and also the language of so many, I think, American fans, you know, who also were just like, what?
Yeah. Well, there's this thing where it's like it's a franchise that at this point lacks, and I know that these are both like cis white male examples, but like they're successful things. It's like it's a franchise that lacks a Dave Filoni or a Kevin Feige, somebody who can cite it chapter and verse, but still figure out where the growth areas are and try and, you know, like make things on the side of the angels and so forth. Because like, as you know, media is created in a very specific point in time, and that point in time is fixed. But the people who enjoy that media, you know, it grows and it changes over time, and you come back to a thing that at one point might have been wholly acceptable. You know, it's like I've been staring at some Tarzan and John Carter of Mars. So like, you know, because I'm trying to get better at, you know, storytelling and seeing the origins of where so many of these things came in. But, you know, if you're reading those things, they're very much of their time. Incredibly sexist, very colonialist. And you kind of like, you have to do the thing where you sort of butcher the art object and take the pieces that are useful for you and leave this stuff that is not, you know, at least for myself, like you leave the stuff that isn't useful or is wrong or, you know, not of the current moment. And it's just like, within this franchise, it's just, we're at the moment, we're at the nexus moment. We're at the moment of how does it grow or change or not?
Yeah, and what do you want to leave behind? I think that's a good way to think of it.
Right. And how do you engage with it as a morally responsible fan? And these are questions for people who are much smarter and from better, more intelligent backgrounds than myself. I'm just a dumb actor, but
obviously not, hardly, because hardly. But, I think that's how it's addressed. I mean, I absolutely think you can have people who are, putting on the academic posh quality to it, but what I love is the on the ground way that people are doing it in their own creative works and their own creative reimaginings. I think that's super important.
Well, it's reaching a lot more people than, our little academic papers that we write about these things. Matt, what are your thoughts about the aspect of critiquing a work you love?
Yeah, well, my favorite thing, just even going back, because all the things Steve just talked about, it's been fascinating to see how, from 2015 to now, the way that we even engage with this property is so different now. And as, the show moved theaters and changed, we kept having to kind of tackle and, deal with various things that were happening within the fandom. But, at that origin point in 2015, the last thing that had really happened with the franchise was the last movie, however many years before. And so my favorite thing I've ever heard was ever told by one of our fans, that one of the reasons he and so many of it, this is John Rosenthal, is the head of the group that shall not be named, one of the bigger fandom groups in New York. He just said that, that the show, the things that are being made fun of are all the same things that someone who grew up reading the series is with another group of people who grew up reading the series, and they're at a bar and they're kind of finding all the flaws and they're laughing while still loving a thing. It's mm-hmm. kind of taking that exact mm-hmm. same energy. There's a way of, still being able to love something while also being, that doesn't quite make sense. And then there's just, a lot of fun to be had with that. But certainly, as Bits wrote these other plays, there was a lot more, actually engaging with the critiques of either, the additions being made or the lack of thought. Even the Puffs 3, Eventfulness Maximus, the kind of core of that is even the idea that if a story is going to keep building and building and building, when does it reach its nexus point? When does it completely implode? Like if you keep on adding things that happened in the past that are somehow much bigger deals than what have happened in the future of the franchise, but no one talked about it then, so it clearly didn't matter. At what point does that, explode a universe?
Is that the Mandalorian?
Yes,
I feel like that's the Mandalorian.
A little bit, yeah. There's a little bit of that there, and that was kind of like it bringing the Fantastic Beast aspect into it. It's like, we talked about Grindelwald, but we didn't really talk about, I don't remember what specific point it was, but. Or just the timeline of it now, being I think we made this bit of now Dumbledore, you can go and fight him now. When are you going to get on that? In 20 years or something like that. But I don't know. It's always coming still from a place, though, of someone who grew up in the feeling that the story gave them. It's always still wanting to respect that feeling while dealing with how that feeling makes you feel now, I guess.
Yeah, and also it's it's true of any franchise that didn't, sure, it was kind of mapped out, but it goes from being, kids mystery novels into a realm of hard fantasy that's obviously not the strong suit, if that makes any sense, in terms of the world building and thing, because it's you lose, as it goes, it sort of loses that Terry Pratchett, Douglas Adams whimsy that's around the edges in the first couple books.
What's the difference of seeing something from a child's eyes into when you start getting it into a teenager, adult's eyes, closer to yours? That's whenever more logical thought starts to happen in a person's life, that's whenever you start being why do they do it like that?
Yeah, it's why everybody's really obsessed with high school. There's 40,000 of them in the UK, and all they do is talk about which part of high school they lived in.
Speaking of perspective and different perspective and point of view and the way that we look at the text, I think the thing that I noticed on my most recent rewatch of Puffs is how much play there is on point of view. So you said the whole, you know, show was sort of conceived as this idea of how would we look at the events of Harry Potter from other students' perspective? What about the Hufflepuff's perspective? But the show sort of relentlessly and for me really refreshingly gives so many opportunities for perspective taking and picking up different points of view. I mean, at one point, we even get the dragon's point of view on having its egg taken away, which always bothered me as a reader. I was always like, this poor dragon, you know? I mean, this has got to be kind of traumatizing for the dragon.
Yeah.
And at one point, we get the point of view of the Death Eater who has just died when someone says, someone has to tell his evil wife and kids, you know? That he's just, not, I mean, it's like, you know, yeah. It just pulls us into a different perspective all of a sudden. But kind of the prevailing perspective is obviously that of this underdog character of Wayne and his community of Hufflepuffs. You know, that gets you thinking that, you know, Potter itself is also an underdog narrative. And at the same time, Puffs really pushes the envelope of making us question the degree of that, you know. So why do you think underdog narratives are important in the first place, and how does Puffs change our perspective on Harry Potter as an underdog narrative?
Just to the second point first, because that was something that we did think about when crafting this, because Harry very much does see himself, you know, the thoughts that we get to peek into throughout the series is that he does treat himself very much like he is an underdog. But the moment that you do take kind of the step back and you start looking at it from the point of view of the other students who would be at that school, like, there's no way they wouldn't hate him to some extent. they would be very sympathetic to his plight, but, you know, by year three, it would just be like, oh my, what's happening now? Why someone's coming to kill him. So we're all here. I want to learn how to pick something up with my wand.
That's like this is the Seamus Finnegan kind of point of view.
Yes, exactly.
Sympathy with that.
So that's kind of that was a big discovery as well whenever I was writing it. It's like, oh, playing with that idea. And that's why, and especially Madeline Bundy's take on the character is also very much playing with how she plays him as, you know, this plucky young adventurer who keeps on somehow getting into these situations and just can't quite understand why it keeps happening to him. And while you have to see the you know, Wayne on the side, who wishes he was in that position, just having to deal with the fallout of all of it. And so I think it very much changes the perspective of Harry, if you're like looking at it from that perspective, just because you're having to see the trail of destruction sort of in the wake of that narrative. That's it, the trail of destruction that's in the wake of probably every hero narrative that's out there, mm-hmm. which is just very funny.
You know, it's funny. I don't think we've actually talked about this. There is, or intentionally talked about this. So it's like Harry kind of just wants to have a normal childhood, but is, you know, thrust by virtue of being in the hero's journey to the, you know, having to act and so forth. Wayne wants an extraordinary life from moment one. So like from moment one, he wants to be the center of the attention. He wants this thing that he doesn't understand. I don't know.
That's in the Mirror of Erised, right? He's saving the wizards with his lightsaber, right? And yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I love is the tagline that you all have for Puffs, which is, it says it's for anyone who's never been destined to save the world. And that's right. So much of what the story is about. It's about the people who aren't destined to save the world. And to me, that is one of the things that gives you that element of, I mean, there's an absurd quality to that idea, you know, that we're following the story of somebody who's not going to save the world. But it's also, it's kind of tragic. And I feel like Wayne's story in the end does have a lot of tragedy built into it. And I wondered how you came to that. You talked about how that was not actually necessarily the direction that you were going in the beginning. But how did you decide to build in that tragic nature of Wayne's, you know.
So it was
destiny.
Always it was always a part of that initial, like, the train ride that I was on, whenever I had this sort of initial idea. I was on the subway, and the idea of Puffs, of like, oh, the perspective of the other students at the school. There were like three ideas that kind of came of it. It was like, oh, it should be about the Puffs. I think I even came up with the title right then. Ron should be played by a mop, and whoever, like, our hero is that we're following should probably be one of the kids who dies. And so that the white room scene, I always knew from that initial like string of ideas that I wanted to do a version like he showed up before Harry and got to have this conversation. It kind of remained pretty unchanged from the initial idea. But what was very different, as Steve mentioned earlier in that initial thing, is that we sort of gave a little bit more of a balm to that idea that Wayne tragically loses his life unfulfilled of any of these goals that he really wanted in his life, that he got to see Cedric and Helga and got to sort of be lifted up as a hero by them, and that he got to come back as a sort of ghost friend. It's what we kind of figured out, though, was leaving the audience on that slightly more tragic note did make Wayne's story feel a little bit more important, because there is something a lot more relatable to the idea that, you know, and this is coming back to that idea of a story for everyone not destined to save the world, is that that explains most of us. That is most of us in our lives. And so it kind of, even just going back to the underdog thing, too, it's like, it made it so in this world that we all kind of picture ourselves, what would we have done if we had gotten that letter? It was sort of another nail in that idea of just like, this kid could easily have just been one of us. And his story is equally as valid and important, even if it didn't have, you know, a lightsaber battle of all lightsaber battles at the end. Because, you know, he lived a life and made some friends and the friends got to remember him by it. And landing on that note just felt so much better in you know, in a way that made you sad and upset than trying to wring out a happy ending from it.
Yeah, and I think that's so much a core part of what the original series is trying to say too. You know, one of the most poignant things for me is when they go to Luna's bedroom and she's got their pictures on the wall, you know, friends all around the room, and I think that's what it's all about. Whether you can save the day or not, it's these relationships that you build, and you're doing your best in your time, and you're, you know, it's a smaller kind of heroism, but just equally important and necessary. And to me, I thought that really got the Harry Potter series at a core level that was even maybe more than what we get from the conclusion of the 7-book series.
Right. And I love the line in the end about how we're all important and unimportant at the same time. And yeah, that's so true. In the original series, Harry longs to be unimportant, you know. And of course, I mean, you know, we can poke fun at that. You know, it's a privileged place to long for unimportance. But still, I think it's just so beautifully illustrated in Wayne's story.
Well, it's also taking the idea seriously that you're sitting in class next to somebody who's literally the chosen one. Like, what does that do to your self-obsessed teenage brain? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. In Star Wars, it made Anakin into Darth Vader, right?
But like, from a stupid arts perspective, it's like, you know, all of us went to acting school, and there are people that we know that are on TV or in these bigger careers and things. And what your like soul goes through journey-wise to understand that like life is more complex than just this sort of binary of win-loss that we're sold through all narrative we consume as a child. You know, before he was, you know, actively undoing the world, we were like, what's it like to sit in class next to Mark Zuckerberg? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's somebody who undeniably does these other things. And especially for like Wayne coming at it from kind of like a individualist American perspective of like, I'm gonna figure out if I'm Han Solo. No, wait, I'm not Han Solo. I'm Peter Parker. I'm whatever. Like, in sort of that way that, you know, when you're growing up and you don't know who you are yet, you try on personalities and things like that. And I think that the sort of like random scattershot points that make up how we all develop our personalities and through the crucible of adolescence is all tied into the thing that is why Wayne's broken ending is so appropriate for what it is. It's getting us all, again, this is more thought that should go into a wizard.
Our little comic. Wizard parody.
Our wizard parody play.
That's what makes it so good.
No, but it's like the end of Our Town, where it's like, oh, do anybody truly experience life when they're living it? Saints and poets, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, it's this thing where it's like, oh no, we all kind of screw up our time doing things, and we think we're going towards a goal, but we weren't aware of our like real impact as we went along. And to get kind of corny, it's like, you know, the band of misfits of the story was also like, this show was made by a bunch of, you know, actors who we, in, you know, writers and creatives who were like, we don't know where we fit into a variety of other things in this industry of ours. Let's make this thing with our friends. And, you know, we're 6 years later, five-ish years later, and, you know, we still regularly Skype and hang out with each other, not just for Puffs promo things, because of the prosaic things that connect us in terms of just having spent so much time with each other that these people who was like, hey, that guy's funny, is now somebody that you're like, oh, maybe that person would be like the best man at my wedding. And that's of so much more importance to the impact on each of our lives as we go through this crazy world than sometimes the giant world-changing events that we might be able to contribute to. And again, you know, and then we have, you know, wand and donut jokes. So it's both them. Dark existential despair and, you know, 27 dresses.
Everything you need.
Yes.
Okay, so I think this is actually one of the, this is actually one of the core questions that the, that your play addresses, that Puffs as a play addresses. There, several times it's like, I'm such a Puff, right? I'm a Puff. What do you think it means to be a Hufflepuff?
You know, I think it kind of just comes right off of what Steve was just saying, is that I think the core value of it is, you know, the idea of like loyalty, of just being a really good friend to people when they need it and when they don't need it. I think that's really the core, and the story that that tells and the story that that leaves behind in your wake, you know, it's not destruction. It's all of this love and good memories that you created. And I think that that's very much to the core of what a Hufflepuff is. It's people who just like look out for each other, despite what the world says to them or about them.
Well, yeah, there was these things in the, again, when we were constructing this and trying to see like what exists in the source text to either be made fun of or to be looked at from a new perspective. One of the things was, is like the fact that this is just a great specific that's in there and kind of nothing is really done with it. But the fact that they stay in the largest amount of numbers out of all of, when faced with fighting down the big bad, they stay unconsciously as most of them to fight for their way of life and their school and things. There's a sort of like a humbleness, a spirit of equality that the, I don't know, that French revolutionary sense of brotherhood, a selflessness, like that there's these things that are like kind of like quiet positives. It's like, you're not necessarily gonna, you're not the bravest in every situation, but like, you know, you're going to stand and wait in the rain for your friend until they're picked up from soccer practice the longest. That's kind of, to some extent, it's like, what do you need more on a day-to-day basis? Somebody who's going to stand up to the ultimate evil, or somebody who got you a slice of pizza because they thought of you when they were getting dollar pizza? It's in that, like, that,
that's
in
loyalty.
But like, that's bloody awesome, and it should be celebrated. And you know, when you're creating arbitrary systems of categorizing 10-year-olds, having having a 10-year-old's brain go like, you're the abstract concept of togetherness is, you know, and this is a thing, and this is funny because it's also, it's like we were doing the show pre them fixing the algorithm on the sorting mechanism on the website. So like, because some executive went like, we need this thing that says like, what house are you, to spit out equal amounts of the things, because, you know, like, because we need to sell scarves in Orlando. It was the people who, like, with a sense of shame unknown by anything, were like, oh, I got sorted into the pubs. And it's like, okay, well, how do we make your day 30% brighter when you think of what this thing is? Because, you know, it's like, some people, their favorite color is yellow. It's not necessarily the one I hear a lot of people saying off the top of their head, but it's like, how do we make you love all that yellow merch you bought?
Yeah, and you know, badgers are actually pretty, pretty cool and hardcore.
Yeah, they're so fierce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll take on anything much larger than them. Right. Which really does, you know, come into the show as well.
Yeah.
Again, there's all these things that are like laying there. You know, it was funny, you know, it's funny to then be in a world where now, you know, a thing like Lower Decks exists for the Trek franchise. And it was like, oh, we were just doing Potter Lower Decks. And we're, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
These things that are traditionally said, like, oh, don't pay attention to those things in the margins. It's like, and actually, sorry, this is off the top of my head, but like, yeah, franchises should pay attention to the people in the margins. Those are people who love you when you still haven't made space for them. So make some GD space for them.
Especially when you're telling an underdog story or you're purporting to tell an underdog story.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, it's also part of the thing of, you know, the movie franchise taking out the economic hardship element that's so central to the books. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the difference between Molly Weasley going like, oh, I'm worried about how we're going to all get school books, to the like sort of more American like can do spirit thing of like, we'll make do somehow. You know what I mean? Like there's the economic anxiety thing of like, that is the bonding initial moment of Harry and Ron's friendship, you know, gets jettisoned because that's not ugly and Hollywoody. And yeah, so it's funny seeing the things in the main mothership that have been stripped away that are those things that you guys were talking about, that you all were talking about, that are the things that are, this is a story that's supposed to be about somebody who's looked over, literally lives under the stairs and takes them to be the center of the universe. Yeah.
Which is what we tried to do.
Yeah. Well, tell me, what's next for both of you? What are your next projects going to be?
Yeah, so as Longley mentioned earlier on, we have a web show that we sort of do off and on at the moment called Guy Choiceman Decides to Save America, The Choosicle, where you do the chooses, which is you vote on a smartphone and to sort of take the story in different directions. You're tasked as every man Guy Choiceman to save America from an evil villain, or you can go work your day job at Staples or Chili's, or you can just go back to bed because you do the chooses. So we just finished a run of that back in over the holidays, but we're going to be bringing it back kind of around other holidays with some special things. So we're going to be bringing it back around Valentine's Day. Otherwise, yeah, whenever theater can happen again, we'll probably be back with our show, the Kapowie Go Go Saga. So stay tuned for that at some point in the future.
Yeah, and we do like readings and online events through our YouTube channel, the Ultra Corporation. That's where it's like you can go see like these. So like when COVID happened and we were like, how the heck can we, you know, as socially responsible wizard comedy people, raise some money for some needy causes? And so we did these online readings of Zoom readings of the other like sequel plays in the Puffsverse. So if you've been listening to us reference them 12 times and going, what the hell are these people talking about? Go to the Ultra Corporation on YouTube and you'll be able to find that. Me and Matt also, in what is a distinctly uncharacteristic twist of fate, are making a 1-minute series on this app called Rizzle. Some of those might start appearing on other stuff in a little bit, but we have one thing on there that's a parody of Are You Afraid of the Dark, called Scary Stories Told in Like 60 Seconds. We have another thing on there called The 1-Minute Baking Show, which starts as a Great British Bake Off sort of homage that quickly becomes a Book of Job-like hellscape. and then we have some other things that'll be coming out with that again. So if you stare at the YouTube things and you go, this 2.5-hour long Zoom reading of a wizard play seems like too much to me, how else can I spend time on stuff you guys work on? And first, A, thank you for being so thorough in trying to find something of our media to engage with when we are only providing you with things that will take up most of your evening. You can find it at Matt Cox and Steven Stout on the app Rizzle. Those series are there, and then we'll have some other things that I'll be posting there that will also be geeky and silly in the coming months. But we'll also be doing some, hopefully, knock on wood, some readings of other plays Matt's written and some other.
Yeah, I have another. Like, we should be doing a reading on the YouTube channel of a play called Witches in Salem, which is a sort of take on the Salem witch trials. That's a fun time that I've been working on. We should do that, and we might.
All the fun of the
Salem witch trials.
Oh right, yeah. It's a thing that kind of treats it like in the same way of Puffs, of like, how do we examine the story of the real tragedy of the history while also looking at it from the crucible pop culture lens, while also plucking two real witches who just happen to be there and are very confused at the goings on. And we also are probably going to do a reading of a pilot that we worked on called Future King. That's a space King Arthur story. And we occasionally also just do like game nights with the cast of Puffs. If you happen to like those people, we'll play like Jackbox games and stuff. So yeah, do check out the Ultra Corporation on YouTube.
Yeah. And if you need to find us on the social media, it's at the Ultra Corp on Twitter and at the _ Ultra _ Corp on Instagram. And I'm at Steve Stout at a variety of different social media things. We plug our things. That's how we don't have a massive operation, so we get the word out through hook and by crook. Sort of the lovely thing about the Puffs journey, to put a bow on it, is that it's always been a thing that's sort of been like shared through word of mouth, through fun people saying to their friends like, hey, there's this thing you might enjoy or check out, or this might. And so like that's how all of our stuff has always succeeded. And we're so grateful that people take it seriously and find some, you know, solace in this thing that started from very humble beginnings.
Yeah, you know, and I'm so glad that you've pointed me to some, you know, some new directions for my. I mean, I am going to continue to watch Puffs, but how great that there's more to this story, and I will definitely be checking that out, and I hope that our listeners will as well. And I just wanted to say this episode, I believe, has been such a. It's been such a perfect combination of, you know, funny. I had to mute myself a lot as I was cackling on the other end, but also just, I think it's got a lot of heart. And I just think that's the way that the play Puffs is too. And how wonderful to get a chance to talk to you both. Thank you so much, Matt Cox and Stephen Stout.
Thank you for having us. This was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much.
What a good conversation. I learned so much, and I am truly going to be spending some time with these other products that you're creating. Just fascinating. We are going to end today's episode with the wisdom of Helga Hufflepuff in the show Puffs, who says, "Why be one thing when you can be everything else?"
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.